You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
National PharmaCare C64 is set to roll out in the coming months, starting with federal coverage for contraceptives and diabetes medications. But how will this multi-billion dollar deal benefit the people of Northwest BC? How much will this actually cost taxpayers, and when will all medications be covered? CICK News put these questions to our Member of Parliament, Taylor Bacharach, to explain how this new legislation will be rolled out. But first, the Gitanyahu Hereditary Chiefs have launched a legal challenge of the Tsilis-Pinda LNG project. On Friday, the Gitanyahu Hereditary Chiefs filed a judicial review of the Tsilis-Pinda LNG project in BC Supreme Court in Vancouver, citing their grave concerns over threats to salmon populations, escalating climate risks, and inadequate consultation with the Gitanyahu Hereditary Chiefs. That coming from a press release issued yesterday. Today, we'll speak with Tara Marsden, WILP Sustainability Director for the Gitanyahu Hereditary Chiefs, about why they're filing the challenge now and what comes next. Stay tuned. You're listening to CICK News.
Hi, this is Tara Marsden. My Gitsan name is Nachink, and I'm working with the Hereditary Chiefs in Gitanyahu as the WILP Sustainability Director and part of the LNG, or the lead on the LNG file for the Gitanyahu Hereditary Chiefs. And we just released this morning a petition that was filed in the courts on Friday. And we have been making our best effort to be included in decision-making on the Tsilis-Pinda LNG terminal in Pierce Island or around Pierce Island, a floating LNG terminal that would connect to the PRGT pipeline. And we have not been accepted as either what they call a participating Indigenous nation in the environmental assessment process, or the province has also not recognized a duty to consult Gitanyahu. And so we have been asking for a pause, a slowdown, inclusion in decision-making, additional data, and all of that has just really fallen on deaf ears with the provincial government. And so we were really left with no other choice but to protect our interests through the courts, which just has commenced.
Yeah, the legal case was filed last week on Friday. What does this mean now? I know you guys have been working on this for a while. So how long has this been going on, trying to get some information from the EAO as well as the provincial government? Obviously, we just went through an election. I'm sure that complicated matters. So how long has this been going on? What has been the process to bring it to this point?
Yeah, so the project has been sort of in the works at the Environmental Assessment Office for a while. And we had been monitoring it, weren't sure if it was going to get advanced, because a lot of times projects might get withdrawn, you know, in the early development phase. And so I'd just been sort of tracking it. But when they opened up for public comment back in November of 2023, that was when things started to really look like they were kind of advancing to the next stage. And so all through that early development phase, there had been no communication from the proponent or from the Environmental Assessment Office to Gitanyahu to see if we felt that we were impacted and that we would be consulted. So what normally happens is there's a certain area of sort of influence or impact that the EAO will consider, and they'll reach out to nations and say, you know, do you feel that you're being impacted by this project? Would you like to consider participating in the assessment? And so none of that had happened in this case. And what we're saying in our petition is that, you know, the province has really known for many, many years that Gitanyahu accesses salmon in the Nass watershed. And we access it at different sites, all of which are known to the provincial government. And we access specific runs. So it could be a part of the main run. It could be part of the Mezi Aden. and other tributaries. And so all of this is common knowledge for the provincial government. And the project site at Pierce Island is not in Gitnau territory, but it is in a migration route for Nass River salmon. And so they did a couple of years of testing, and they found juvenile salmon. So that's the juveniles that are coming from the freshwater, potentially in our territory, out through the mouth of the Nass River into the estuary and then out into the ocean. And so they knew that. They knew that Nass River salmon juveniles were transitioning through this area. There's some bull kelp, which could be habitat for those salmon. And they still did not notify Gitnau. They still did not outreach. And so during the public comment period in November 2023, we reached out and said, this is of concern. We're concerned about juvenile salmon. We're also concerned about climate impacts and greenhouse gas emissions, and would like to be consulted. And so there was a back and forth correspondence chain between Gitnau and the Environmental Assessment Office, as well as the proponent. And at the end of that, the EAO was still of the mind that there was no duty to consult Gitnau. And the real kicker here is that in March of this year, the EAO said there's no duty to consult Gitnau because there are no impacts to salmon. They're negligible impacts to salmon. And this was before they even had a final application to review. And so it was a very premature determination. And this is, you know, sadly, this is kind of par for the course for the EAO. They really have a predetermined process. 99% of the projects that go through the EA end up getting approved. It's just what mitigations are put in place. And so that was really a sign that they were not taking the review process seriously. They still have to hear from a bunch of other First Nations. They heard also from the Gitxsan, who asked to participate and were also excluded. So there's all of these other things that haven't been reviewed, that mitigations haven't been proposed, and things like the habitat offset plans, when you do disrupt or destroy fish habitat, those are months, maybe years away. And so they've made this very premature determination without including everyone who relies on salmon. And so that's really the challenge that we're bringing forward to the courts.
Yeah, Tara, there's a lot to unpack there. Obviously, this is a complicated issue on a number of fronts. But this is something that also has turned into a physical blockade along Highway 37 there in Gitnau territory, stopping trucks, LNG trucks from getting to a work site because they're trying to do some work there to get a substantial start. This is longstanding concerns that you and others, that the Gitnau Hereditary Chiefs and others in those communities have had on this project for some time. This just seems like, from what you're describing, it was inevitable. Where do you see this going from here? How do you see this kind of playing out? If this does have to go through the courts, would it necessarily put a stop to some of the work that's going on? And also, I know that there's also a question of some of the ways that the permitting took place, and maybe a lack of oversight from the regulator when this all got started. So tell me a little about, where does this go from here?
Yeah, so the on-the-ground action that Gitnau has taken is related to PRGT. And so these two projects are now linked, but they're actually being reviewed separately, and they have very different processes attached to them. And so the pipeline, as your listeners may know, was approved back in 2014. At that time, it was approved to go to Leelu Island. Leelu Island, though, did not get approved. So Lac-Aux-Lames, Gitnau, Lake Babine, a whole host of nations who also fish in the Skeena watershed, same thing. Estuaries are very hard to build in because they're so critical for juvenile salmon. And so very similar issues for the Leelu Island terminal, poor siting, poor location. And that one did not get approved. That went through the courts as well. So PRGT was just this pipeline to nowhere for 10 years, and then it was revived through the Nishka proposal for Xelisms and then the Nishka purchase of the PRGT pipeline. And so the PRGT pipeline, they've started some minimal construction in Nishka core lands and have until November 25th to demonstrate some type of substantial start. So then that starts a whole nother regulatory process where they put in an application. There is consultation and review by nations and potential legal actions there as well. And anything that's a major decision is potentially vulnerable to legal action. Sorry, I just had to decline a call. And so the permitting for the pipeline as well is being challenged, not by Gitnyau, but by others, the Kispiox Band and Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition and others represented by EcoJustice. And so a whole host of issues that we've also been experiencing with Gitnyau through the permitting process, the splitting of the Section 5 permit without clear, transparent rationale why they were doing it. We were asking at the time, back in January, February of this year, you know, what is the regulatory path here? Are they trying to get another extension, another five-year extension, or are they trying to get substantial start? No one would answer that. But in the meantime, the BC Energy Regulator was actively facilitating the splitting of a Section 5 pipeline permit so that the Nisga could start construction in their core lands without consulting anybody and without actually fulfilling those permit requirements, which included a cumulative effects assessment as well as a final investment decision on the terminal. So a lot of bending of the rules to try and get, you know, grease the wheels to get this pipeline through and potentially get a substantial start. And as you mentioned, with the provincial election, there's a lot of uncertainty on who forms government. And we saw through the campaign that the BC Greens were the most vocal about PRGT and saying that it required a new assessment, it was out of date, and that, you know, investing more into fossil fuels is not going to help us reach our emission reduction targets and not going to be a climate solution. And so NDP a little more quiet, but certainly having been in power for a number of years, they are the ones who have been in charge of really actively facilitating this revival of PRGT and potentially Xelisms as well. And the Conservatives, I think we all know where they're standing. So yeah, definitely a lot to look at in the next couple of months in terms of where this goes. And I don't have a crystal ball. We can only do our best to try and protect our land, protect our fish, and really try and take care of our climate. And yeah, we don't know what the outcomes will be.
Tara, just the last thing for you. I know we've spoken about Gitnyau rights before on the territory in a number of situations last year. I remember speaking about the protected area, the expansion of the protected area. Why do you feel that this issue of Gitnyau rights, Indigenous rights, when these sort of situations come up, there continues to be pushback from the government, as you mentioned, the NDP government. Why do you think there continues to be this pushback when these issues come up, knowing that you know, they've created and legislated a United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act to make sure that stuff like this is dealt with in a more constructive manner? So what are your feelings on that?
Yeah, I think that there is a certain perception that the NDP want to keep alive about who they are and what they stand for. I think that the tail end of this of their term really kind of showed that they weren't as committed as people thought they would be. And going into the election, they were much more interested in appealing to potential Conservative voters. And so they really downplayed a lot of their conservation goals, a lot of their Indigenous rights goals. And we're trying to play it more safe, I would say, with the Green Party potentially forming the balance or you know, becoming the balance of power. There's a little more hope, but that's, you know, that's a slim margin of hope, I would say. In terms of why they keep pushing back, you'd have to ask them. But honestly, I think that there's a certain realization as governments and the industry's power and hold over government in this province is very longstanding. And so I think that when they promise something and then they see the reality of it and what it means, I think they're responding to a lot of pressure from industry and then from this kind of blue wave of conservative folks that are now quite mobilized. And so it's always tough to see that, we, you know, we labored under the BC Liberal government for many years and their obsession with LNG, and we got NDP in, we thought things would be different, and they're not. So it is very challenging. It's very, very challenging to try and make any progress in protecting our lands and our waters and to have our rights respected and upheld. It doesn't get easier, unfortunately.
Okay, Tara, we'll leave it there for now, but thanks so much for giving us your time and insight on this issue, and I'm sure we'll speak again.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
That was Tara Marsden, WILP Sustainability Director for the Gitignau Hereditary Chiefs, speaking about their recently launched legal challenge for the Cy Lism's LNG project. Coming up next, my conversation with MP Taylor Bacharach about the recently adopted legislation on pharmacare.
Taylor Bacharach, I'm the Member of Parliament for Skeena-Buckley Valley, and I'm here today in my home community of Smithers, about to head out to Terrace for some meetings this afternoon.
Taylor, thanks so much for being with us here on CSAK News again. Of course, as you know, the House and the Senate passed Bill C-64, the Pharmacare Act, recently. It is now law in Canada. But how are British Columbians and Northwest BC going to benefit from this new legislation, and how is it going to be rolled out?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Dan. And maybe I'll start at sort of the 10,000-foot level. Canada is the only country in the world that has universal health care but lacks a universal pharmacare program of some sort. And so for decades, we've been pushing for prescription medication to be added to our healthcare system. Because the reality is that people can go to a doctor for free. That's the, you know, the big advantage of our universal system. But if your doctor prescribes medication for your condition and you don't have private insurance, a lot of people in Canada are either foregoing the medication altogether and not filling the prescription, or they're getting the prescription and they're taking a lower dosage so that they can stretch those that medicine out over a longer period of time. In some really extreme cases, people are having to choose between other household expenses like buying groceries or paying the heating bill and taking the medication their doctor prescribed. Those aren't choices that any Canadian should have to make. And so that's why we're so proud that the Canada Pharmacare Act has finally been passed into law. This was something that we managed to force the government to do using our position in this minority parliament to get something done that's going to improve the lives of millions of Canadians. So now that it's law, the federal government is going to be negotiating province by province in a similar way to the way the federal government has been negotiating the childcare program. And as provinces come on board, people are going to be able to access coverage for, to start with, three categories of drugs. But our hope is that this really expands into a comprehensive pharmacare program that covers all of the basic medications that people need.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, one of the things that a lot of people are talking about is, you know, the availability of certain drugs right now that are hugely expensive for many, like insulin. What are some of the specifics that you know of right now that are going to be covered? I know there's, you know, quite a long process to see this roll out across the country. But what do we know right now of what is going to be the first few drugs to be accessible under this new bill?
So the good news for British Columbians is that the BC government, prior to the election period, signed a memorandum of understanding with the federal government and essentially said, as soon as Bill C-64 becomes law, we're going to move ahead with this pharmacare program in lockstep with the federal government. And the memorandum of understanding commits to providing three main categories of prescription medication at the start. Those categories are diabetes medication and devices. The second one is contraception. And the third one is hormone replacement therapy medications. These are three categories of very common medications that cost people a lot of money. In the case of contraception, the BC government has already been covering it for a few years now. But this will bring it under the federal program, and it will bring federal funds to the province to cover those prescriptions. So, you know, when you add up all the people that are affected either by diabetes medication costs or hormone replacement. Or the third category, there's like that's hundreds of thousands of Canadians that are affected. So I think it's going to be a real game changer. Hopefully by the spring, people will actually be able to get that coverage. So that's where things stand right now. I was in Ottawa when it passed in the Senate, and it was a pretty exciting moment. This is something that has been a vision for so long. And to think about people's lives being improved in really, really tangible ways, I think it makes a lot of the stuff that we put up with in Ottawa worthwhile.
Taylor, how much is this going to cost the federal government?
Well, it's a phased program. So the first phase, it really depends on how many provinces come on board. If provinces don't come on board, then the federal government isn't going to transfer the money to them, and the overall cost of the program will be less. There was a report by Dr. Eric Hoskins a number of years ago. He was asked by the government to look into pharmacare and the need for it and what the costs would be and make recommendations around how to structure the program. And I think he found that a comprehensive pharmacare program would cost about $11 billion a year across the country. Now, what you have to account for are the savings to society, because we know that when people don't take the medication that they're prescribed, they get sicker and they end up in our emergency rooms. So, you know, if you look at those savings, plus the savings that come from being able to negotiate with the big pharmaceutical companies, the net cost would be substantially less than that $11 billion.
Taylor, aside from this, you also got some other news that you released the other day, that you're taking on some new responsibilities in the House as the Rural Economic Development critic, as well as the deputy critic for finance. Tell me a little about these roles. What are you taking on now?
Yeah, these are exciting roles. We recently won a by-election in Manitoba, so we have a new member of parliament in our caucus, Leela Dance. And as a result of that win and that addition to our team, there have been some changes in roles. And I was really pleased to take on the rural economic development critic role, because I think it's something that speaks to the region that we live in. And I've lived in rural communities most of my life, and seeing the way that rural economies are tied to these boom and bust commodity cycles really highlights the need for a long-term economic vision, one that doesn't just see rural regions as places to extract resources from, but places that are worthy of investment and communities that are going to be there for the long run. So that means we need to create economies that are sustainable. We need to create places that are vibrant, that can attract people from around the world to come and live as residents and contribute. And it takes a little bit of a shift to get there. So I'm really excited to have a chance to talk about that stuff in the House of Commons and to bring the ideas from our communities to Ottawa and hopefully get some traction for them there.
All right, Taylor, thanks so much for checking in with us again, and good luck in your new roles. I'm sure we'll speak about them in the near future.
Thanks so much, Dan. Good to talk to you as always, and have a good day out there.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or check us out on the web at smithersradio.com. CICK News has been made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to my colleague Pam Hassan and all of our roving journalists, I'm Daniel Messick. Thanks for listening.
Learn more about CICK. Visit us at smithersradio.com. Yeah, .com.